The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Doris Hyde from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the sound prints for July 16th is now online from the ACB Kentucky group, interviewing patients with NMOSD. If you have it, you know what it is. Audio Description Award winners, Disability and Job Churn in Canada that I missed last week, How Ride Hailing Could Improve Public Transit, also missed from last week, and the NFB versus Greyhound suit has been settled. A different motorcycle gang in Canada rides for the blind. Today's reading of Vision News is underwritten by an anonymous gift in loving memory of Joe and Kelly. First up, the Sound Prints magazine, audio magazine, for July 16th is now online. ACB highlights for the past year, corporate and individual convention sponsors, Microsoft wins ACB Olson Award, report on unemployment of people with disabilities, Kentucky Mockingbird sings at night, class action suit filed in New York City, need more audible signals. http://www.kentucky-acb.org/soundprints. Link to subscribe to the Sound Prints Audio Magazine podcast with the extension .xml. If you have any questions about the Sound Prints Audio Magazine, contact the Kentucky Council of the Blind. Phone 502-895-4598. Email kcb@kentucky-acb.org. Contact the Kentucky Council of the Blind at 502-895-4598. Forwarded from Sharon Lovering, received the information below and was certain that many of you would be able to assist. Please pass this along to all your members. We are looking for patients with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, NMOSD. Research details. A. National telephone and web interviews, July 30th through August 10th. B. Looking for patients ages 18 to 60 who have been diagnosed with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder who are currently being treated by a doctor. C. Participants will be paid $125 for their 60-minute web and telephone interview. If you're interested, send an email to patientresearch@schlesingergroup.com with your name, state of residence, and telephone number. That's patient.research@schlesingergroup.com. Sharon Lovering, Editor, American Council of the Blind, 1703 North Beauregard Street, Suite 420, Alexandria, Virginia, 22311. slovering@acb.org. Learn more about us at www.acb.org. Joel Snyder proudly announces the ACB 2018 Achievement Awards in Audio Description, an initiative of the Council's Audio Description Project, ADP. In conjunction with ACB's 57th Annual Conference and Convention in St. Louis, Missouri, the awards were presented at a plenary session of the conferences before 1,000 people who are blind ACB members and convention attendees. The prestigious awards included Achievement in Audio Description, Performing Arts, Mind's Eye Radio, Belleville, Illinois, for its work providing description for the Muni in St. Louis, the St. Louis Shakespeare Theater, Shakespeare in the Streets, the Rep and the Black Rep, Stray Dog Theater, Inevitable Theater Company, Metro Theater Company, the Tennessee Williams Festival, and its work with LAMP, Interpreting Service, providing audio description for a series of medically oriented films produced in several languages. Its description activity extends to audio description at the St. Louis Zoo, the Missouri Botanical Gardens, the Mola Shrine Circus, Disney on Ice, the VIP Parade, the Solar Eclipse, and the establishment of a seminar on website accessibility through its Arts and Culture Accessibility Cooperative. Achievement in Audio Description Media. Rooted in Rights, Seattle, Washington, for its video and social media advocacy program, focused exclusively on stories about disability rights. All of the nearly 200 original videos produced since 2015 have featured audio description. Achievement in Audio Description Visual Art. Museums, visitor centers, Tennessee School for the Blind and Julia Cawthon, Nashville, Tennessee, for their hosting of a unique event on August 21st, 2017, to bring a live audio description of the solar eclipse to all the blind and visually impaired students at TSB and to thousands of blind people around the world through the live broadcast on ACB Radio. Achievement in Audio Description International. Amos Baer, CEO of the Central Library for the Blind and Visually Impaired Individuals, Tel Aviv, Israel, for work establishing an audio description service, an operation that allows the inclusion of hundreds of blind and visually impaired people in theater performances, movies, museums, ceremonies, and live events. Special Recognition Achievement in Audio Description International, Antonio Vasquez Martin, Aristia Producciones, SLU, Madrid, Spain, for his work with students in the Spanish Translation Program at Montclair State University, developing a free-of-charge 20-hour training course on audio description. Dr. Margaret R. Fonsteel Memorial Achievement Award in Audio Description, awarded to Research and Development, Dr. Francisco Lima, Recife, Brazil, for his work developing guidelines for scientific audio description, focusing on entomology descriptions. Dr. Lima details how audio description in scientific settings differs from audio description for films and theater and can benefit audio describers who are interested in applying their skills in a science setting. He also developed an app, SnapSect, designed to make it easier for people who are blind or have low vision to access scientific audio description. This app promises to greatly facilitate access to scientific exhibits from museums to zoos. Barry Levine Memorial Award for Career Achievement in Audio Description go to the Carl and Ruth Shapiro Family National Center for Accessible Media at WGBH NCAM for its more than 20 years researching, developing, and customizing tools, guidelines, and technology that lowers the barriers to providing and accessing high-quality image and audio description. The achievement awards are made to individuals and/or organizations for outstanding contributions to the establishment and/or continued development of significant audio description programs. The Barry Levine Memorial Award for Career Achievement in Audio Description recognizes an individual for outstanding contributions to the field of audio description over an extended period of time, leading, inspiring, or providing significant service to others. Audio description uses words that are succinct, vivid, and imaginative to convey the visual image from television, film, DVDs, theater, museums, and many other settings, stated Kim Charlson, president of the American Council of the Blind. The organizations and individuals honored with these awards are among the leaders in description. They help make so many aspects of our culture accessible to people who are blind or have low vision. They deserve this special recognition. Additional information about ACB's audio description project is available at www.acb.org/ADP. From www.policyalternatives.ca, Disability and the Job Churn. In 2016, Finance Minister Bill Morneau told reporters that millennials needed to get used to job churn, a career path eked out from short-term and precarious work. Prime Minister Trudeau welcomed the idea of the churn, saying that changing jobs frequently allowed workers to have new experiences, but treating growing precarity as the welcome and inevitable evolution of Canada's job market shifts undue burden onto workers. If you are struggling to exist in this new system, it's not the system's fault. It's yours for not being resilient enough. The job churn celebrates the notion of the grind, glorifies busyness, and encourages abandonment of any semblance of work-life balance. Good things come to those who hustle, we are told. This new intensified employment landscape, with its increased expectations and decreased protections for workers, is simply not a possibility for many people, and it leaves disabled Canadians totally sidelined. for the 10.1% of working-age Canadians who are disabled, struggling to find full employment is already a churn. Before getting to why that's the case, some housekeeping on the term disability is needed. For the purposes of this article, disabled workers are those individuals who are or want to be in the labor force who also have a physical or mental disability. Physical disabilities may be visible, related to mobility, for example, or invisible, chronic illnesses. Mental disabilities include mental illness like post-traumatic stress disorder, neurodevelopmental disorders such as autism, and learning disabilities such as dyslexia. Statistics Canada delineates a disability into 10 categories: pain-related, dexterity, developmental, mobility, flexibility, hearing, mental health, memory, learning, and seeing. Canadians with disabilities face exceptionally high rates of unemployment. Over 400,000 disabled working-age Canadians are currently unemployed, despite being willing and able to work. While Canada's unemployment rate is currently sitting at about 5.8%, the rate for disabled Canadians is much higher. Canadians with mild disabilities are most likely to find employment, and their unemployment rate is 35%. For those with, quote, severe disabilities, the rate jumps to 74%. Put another way, for every one person with a severe disability who finds work, three do not. When disabled workers do find employment, it is often in sales, and they make far less money than their abled counterparts. While the median personal income in 2012 for a Canadian worker was 31,200 Canadian, for disabled workers it ranged from 10,800 to 24,200, depending on their disability type. As a result, researcher Michael Prince laments, Canadians with disabilities have not seen the promise of equality of opportunity in the labor market fulfilled. In the 1970s and 1980s, the federal government introduced several anti-discrimination and employment equity measures designed to reduce barriers to employment. The Employment Equity Act, for example, requires employers to be proactive in identifying and eliminating employment barriers against persons in four designated groups: women, visible minorities or racialized people, people with disabilities, and Indigenous peoples. Similarly, the Canadian Human Rights Act states that employers have a duty to accommodate disabled employees and to take all steps short of undue hardship to eliminate discrimination. But legislation on its own has not addressed the divide between disabled workers and the rest of the workforce. Between 13.5% and 34.6% of disabled workers believe that they have been refused a job in the past 5 years because of their disability. More broadly, a recent BMO survey found that 48% of Canadians believe a person is more likely to be hired or promoted if they hide their disability. Given both these findings, it is not surprising that 20.4% to 36.7% of Canadian Survey on Disability, CSD, respondents reported that their employer was unaware of their disability. More than 30 years after anti-discrimination measures were enacted, people with disabilities continue to face discrimination while looking for work and experience additional disadvantages such as lower compensation and weaker job tenure, according to CSD reports. Clearly, the work to eliminate discrimination and barriers facing disabled Canadians has been left unfinished. Rather than assessing where the failures are in the policies we've enacted, our leaders are pressing ahead with unbridled enthusiasm into the churn, leaving disabled workers to navigate a gig economy with even fewer protections than the broken system we had before. The gig economy refers to an employment landscape wherein temporary positions are common, if not the norm, and organizations contract with independent laborers for parcels of work, bit jobs. Though the arrival of app-driven employers like Uber, Upwork, and Hire gets much of the attention when we talk about job churn, temp agencies, zero-hour contracts, i.e. short-notice retail shifts, and declining union membership all contribute to today's rise in precarious forms of work. According to Randstad Canada, freelancers, independent contractors, and consultants now make up 20 to 30% of the Canadian workforce. More notably, 85% of the companies surveyed by Randstad intend to adopt a more agile workforce in the near future. What makes the gig economy so alluring for employers is that it shifts a great deal of risk and responsibility to workers. Gig employers have have lower overhead costs. Drivers for Uber, for example, provide their own cars. Workers with hire are classified as independent contractors, and as such, restaurants hiring them need not contribute to their Canadian PP or EI. Upwork allows firms to completely outsource all their creative and clerical needs. So where does disabled workers fit in? Duty to accommodate states that employers are required to address employment barriers with one exception, the bona fide occupational requirement, BFOR. An employer can argue that they do not have a duty to accommodate if an aspect of a job cannot be modified or adapted without undue hardship for the employer. The gig economy, which has stripped away employers' responsibilities to their employees, has created an entire labor ecosystem within BFOR loophole. It is a labor market that survives on nimbleness and just-in-time delivery of labor services, a system that by design does not have room for accommodation, especially not a disabled worker's need for an adapted schedule or access to assistive devices, for example. While the gig economy is a subsection within Canada's labor market, its ethos helps shape the broader employment environment wherein millennials born between the early 80s and early 2000s are increasingly told that they need to settle for less. The Poverty and Employment in Southern Ontario Research Project, PEPSO, reports that 52.9% of non-unionized workers aged 25 to 44 don't have health benefits, and 47.7% don't have paid time off from work. Benefits are critically important for disabled workers, as more than three-quarters of people with disabilities take prescription medication. The medication issue speaks to the larger vulnerability that disabled workers now face in Canada's changing labor landscape. Increasingly, disabled millennials looking for work are reading job postings whose details subtly suggest the employer is only interested in hiring abled workers. In advance of writing this article, I asked a group of disabled millennials to tell me what keywords in job postings caused them to self-select out of applying for work. At the top of the list were ideal candidate descriptors like plucky, high energy, able to go above and beyond, enthusiastic, and always on. When it comes to duty descriptions, the workers who spoke to me said their red flags were around being expected to take on extra evening and weekend work and to strive for perfect attendance, sometimes incentivized through bonuses. From these conversations, a clear image begins to form of the working world that disabled millennials navigate. Yes, Mr. Morneau, it is one that is shaped by churn culture. These postings go beyond a mentality of doing less with more. They are looking for a gig-style availability from their employees, always on, always ready to jump in on a project regardless of the hour, their health at the moment, and whether overtime will be compensated. Even job postings that end with the accessibility statements paint a picture of their ideal ideal candidate as someone who might need accommodation but would never ask for it because they are so grateful for the work and so enthusiastic about being part of the team. This climate leaves disabled millennials with an impossible choice: apply for jobs that expect the successful candidate to be always on and risk declining health to meet these expectations, or try to find a workplace that isn't operating under a maximum extraction approach to management. Increasingly, those positions are harder and harder to find. With the federal government celebrating flexible employment, there's an obvious lack of political will to ensure that disabled Canadians are able to pursue meaningful careers. It's not enough to shrug off this marginalization of disabled workers as the cost of innovation. Over a million Canadians are waiting for the employment equity measures of the last century to take hold and for a guarantee that the coming churn won't leave them in tatters. Katie Razzo is Digital Communications Officer at the CCPA and has worked with a variety of progressive organizations, including Canadian Doctors for Medicare in Toronto and Media Democracy Days in Vancouver. From theconversation.com, we have How Ride-Hailing Could Improve Public Transportation Instead of Undercutting It by Daniel Sperling, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Founding Director, Institute of Transportation Studies, UC Davis, and Austin Brown, Executive Director, Policy Institute for Energy, Environment, and the Economy, UC Davis, and Molly D'Agostino, Policy Director, Three Revolutions Future Mobility Program, Institute of Transportation Studies, UC Davis. Over the last half decade, public transit ridership declined nationwide. The number of vehicle miles traveled in cars is rising, and traffic congestion is getting worse in many U.S. cities. At the same time, the century-old taxi industry is struggling, and with many taxi companies going bankrupt, are ride-hailing companies such as Lyft and Uber to blame? What has been their impact, and what should be done? While ride-hailing threatens public transit, it is also key to its future success, but only with smart policies and the right price signals. As researchers working at the intersection of energy, the environment, and public policy, we have been analyzing transportation trends for decades and seeing remarkably little innovation. Now we are on the cusp of major transformations. We see ride-hailing through the framework laid out in Daniel Sperling's new book, Three Revolutions, Steering Automated, Shared, and Electric Vehicles to a Better Future. A 2018 survey of ride-hailing users in metropolitan Boston found that nearly half would have used public transit if ride-hailing had not been available. Cited MAPC-CCBY-ND. More travel, less mass transit. Let's start with the data. Public transit ridership dropped in 31 of 35 U.S. major metropolitan areas in 2017. It has declined by 3% since 2014, and 2017 was the lowest year of overall transit ridership since 2005. Meanwhile, the total U.S. vehicle miles traveled, or VMT, has increased steadily since 2011. Most dramatically, Lyft, Uber, and other ride-hailing companies have soared from near zero trips in 2012 to about 2.6 billion in 2017. Why is this happening? People are choosing ride hailing because transit does not match the comfort and convenience offered by private vehicles, and taxis cannot offer the affordability and transparency of an app-based ride hailing. VMT is increasing as growing numbers of for-hire cars log deadhead miles driving to pick up passengers or returning from destinations. In New York City, unoccupied taxi and ride hailing hours grew by 81% from 2013 to 2017. But the net effects are highly region-dependent. Dense urban markets are responding differently from suburbs. In San Francisco, fully one-third of Lyft and Uber drivers use ride-hailing in lieu of public transit. A survey in Denver found that 22% of respondents would have used transit had ride-hailing been unavailable. In contrast, researchers found that only 3% of Lyft and Uber riders in Austin switched to transit during a suspension of ride-hailing services. Positive impacts, too. While ride-hailing is pulling riders away from public transit in some places, it can also enhance transit ridership. The UC Berkeley survey found that 4% of Uber and Lyft customers ended their rides at transit stations, which suggests that they were using ride-hailing to connect to transit. Our colleague Carolyn Rodier has observed that multiple surveys show about 5% of respondents relying on ride-hailing to access transit, although Rodier concluded that the increased transit trips are offset by diversion of trips away from transit. Local governments and agencies can work with ride-hailing services to enhance public transit instead of undermining it. For instance, ride-hailing can help smooth transportation demand shocks caused by temporary transit disruptions, such as closures of subway stations for maintenance. What's more, while ride-hailing may increase car-based travel, this is not necessarily a bad thing. More mobility increases access to jobs, health care, and education. And a significant percentage of ride-hailing trips occur late at night when congestion is not a big concern and transit options are not always available. Indeed, its late-night popularity suggests that ride-hailing is removing some of the most dangerous type of vehicle miles. According to a UT Austin study of all 273 U.S. cities with a population of more than 100,000, ride-hailing services reduced fatal drunk driving crashes by 10 to 11%. Ride-hailing also offers greater independence for elderly and disabled populations. The Center for American Progress observes that ride-hailing can help disadvantaged populations overcome geographic isolation and access jobs, education, and healthcare services. Complementing public transit. For transit agencies, ride-hailing services can be an attractive alternative to serving sparsely populated, low-density areas with fixed routes and schedules. Private mobility companies and public transit agencies agencies have launched nearly 50 pilot projects and partnerships to explore these opportunities. Many agencies are subsidizing travel and ride-hailing vehicles to meet the needs of certain rider groups. In San Clemente and Dublin, California, officials canceled fixed-route buses with the lowest ridership and provided discounts for people to travel in Lyft and Uber. Phoenix is discounting the price of ride-hailing trips to and from 500 city bus stops. Denver is offering free rides to suburban light rail stations. Reducing solo travel. The number of innovative transit partnerships is growing rapidly, but the jury is still out on what types of partnerships can yield win-wins for communities, companies, and transit agencies. An overarching goal should be to increase mobility, that is, passenger miles traveled, while reducing vehicle miles traveled. This will only happen if ride-hailing services continue to shift toward multi-passenger services such as Lyft Line and Uber Pool. Such a change will require policy frameworks that encourage shared rides and discourage single-passenger rides, starting with ride-hailing services and eventually including travelers using their own vehicles. Road pricing practices in which drivers pay fees to travel in high-use areas have reduced traffic and increased pooled rides and transit trips in London, Stockholm, and Singapore. Importantly, Uber and Lyft embrace these strategies to expand pooling services and gain relief from stifling traffic congestion just like the rest of us. Pooling and road pricing will be especially critical with the coming vehicle automation revolution. If automated vehicles are individually owned, they will likely generate massive new vehicle use since travel will no longer be as onerous. Occupants can sleep, eat, text, read, and watch videos while their cars do the navigating. But if those automated vehicles are pooled, the vehicle use would be pushed in the opposite direction toward fewer vehicle miles traveled. U.S. cities and transit operators have done little innovating in the past 50 years and are ill-prepared for the changes ahead. They need to decipher what is happening, build partnerships, and support price signals that encourage pooling. Acting to maximize the societal benefits of ride-hailing and other transportation revolutions will provide benefits now and into the future. From RideForSight.com, we have Motorcyclists Fighting Blindness. The Great Canadian Tradition Continues. We are the Great Canadian Motorcycling Tradition, perhaps the ride that started them all. But more importantly, we raise money for vision research. We're your brothers and sisters, your mothers and fathers, your sons and daughters, your uncles and aunts, your grandparents and great-grandparents. We come from all walks of life, from all parts of this wonderful country, and we ride everything imaginable. We collect donations on behalf of the Foundation Fighting Blindness, Canada, and we come together each year in celebration of our fundraising efforts at various points across the country. It all began in 1979. A small group of riders rode through the summer afternoon, miles of highway stretched ahead. Just as the sun began to dip below the horizon, one of the riders, Jack, started to lose his bearings when he felt dimness quickly close around the road ahead. Noticing something was wrong, Jack's buddies moved into a close formation around his bike and used their high beams to illuminate the road home. When they reached their destination, Jack parked his bike for the last time. Soon after, he was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, one of the many blinding eye diseases that affect over a million Canadians today. This wasn't the end of the group's passion for riding. In hopes of finding a cure for their friend, Jack's pals created what would become the longest-running charity motorcycle ride in the country, Ride for Sight. Since then, Ride for Sight has raised over $26 million for the Foundation Fighting Blindness, Canada's leading charity organization funding vision research. From its humble beginnings, Ride for Sight has grown from a small local fundraising event to a national initiative with several rides taking place across Canada each year. 2018 will mark the 40th anniversary of Ride for Sight in Canada. We've run out of time for today's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Doris Hyde reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Call 919-832-5138 for comments and questions.